Okay, can you all hear me okay?
Yeah.
Can we move away from the mic? Still hear me?
Yeah.
And over here as well. That's good. Right, I can meander around. I'm a bit of a fidgety person. I'll try to fall off the edge. Right, I've called this talk here at 4 o'clock, so you've got no idea what time it is. So can you give us a sort of 5-minute warning?
Yeah, I'll be able to do
it. I've called this talk here, Climate Change Going Beyond Dangerous. I should say, we're going to start off with this as a confession. Actually, I used to work in the oil industry for quite a few years, so I'm trying to remedy some of the bad that I did. But I don't know if all of you not consume the stuff that I produced out of the North Sea anyway, so we're all of it together. So I'm going to call this Going Beyond Dangerous. And there's some subtitle, Brutal Numbers and Tenuous Hope. And I'm often accused of being a doomster. I don't think I'm a doomster at all, I just play with a few numbers. And they happen to be quite unfortunate and unattractive looking numbers when it comes to what that means for our lives. So I call them brutal numbers in terms of what it means we have to do and the impacts that may come out of those numbers. Tenuous hope. I think we still have a thin thread of hope. It'll be thinner this evening because we'll have emitted more carbon dioxide today from this talk than everywhere else around the planet. And so each day the hope gets thinner. But we can also rely on what we've done for a long time, which is a posh academic term of hypocrisy. Stuff your head in the ground, pretend it's not happening, it's someone else's fault. We've got several hundred years of Britain doing just that. So we're well experienced in the latter approach. And before I think about climate change, I think there was a question we're really trying to address. A lot of people say I work on climate change and they're trying to tweak some fuel injector in a new car or whatever else it happens to be. And they're not really engaging with it from a big picture perspective. And you know, maybe they shouldn't all have to, but for me, I think it is important to say, well, what is it I'm trying to address at the system level, which is the sort of level that I tend to work at. Now, this is from the Copenhagen Accord, the big sort of debacle that occurred in Denmark a few years ago. Actually, the good thing about debacles is the lawyers went home. And so this came out of it, without the lawyers playing with it, so this is quite amazing, really. To hold the increasing global temperature below 2 degrees Celsius and take action to meet this consistent with the science, but a radical idea for policymakers to suggest that. Even more radical, something to do with equity. Now, I'm not going to talk much about science, and Matt will do more of that later, we can discuss some of those issues. I take the science as broadly satisfactory for us to work from there in terms of emissions and then into policy, but like all good science, there's a lot of uncertainty here. And the equity issue as well is just hugely important. So I'm taking that. Whether I agree that 2 degrees C is the appropriate threshold to be acceptable and dangerous is a different issue, and we can come back to that later. But in time of today, I can't really go into that in any detail. The question that then arises, if we do accept 2 degrees C, and it's a political but a scientific decision, science doesn't tell you 2 is the appropriate threshold between acceptable and dangerous. Politics and social discourse tells you that, and science informs it. What mitigation gives a good chance of staying at or below 2 degrees C? Then how do we split the cake amongst the OECD, the various terms for this, and the non-OECD, the wealthy and the less wealthy parts of the world? How do you split the cake of what we can do and or the space that we have in terms of emissions? Now, these are things that you're probably all familiar with. And I'm going to talk quite quick through all this, and you won't have to follow it all, but you can well have the slides later, and I can put you towards presentations with all of this on it. These are sort of the things we normally see. We all love this. Large reductions by not in my term of office, which means we leave it to our children, we leave it to technology, we leave it to something in the future, we'll solve the problem by 2050, which is utter clapture, has nothing to do with science. The CO2 that comes out from burning the electricity for the lights in here, from this laptop, from us traveling here, will be affecting the atmosphere for the next 100 to 200 years. So whether this event has any effect on the climate, from our changing our behaviour, it certainly has an effect on the climate from pumping up into the atmosphere by holding the event. So we will be affecting the climate. And because of that, we're trying to do the targets have nothing to do with 2 degrees centigrade. They are unrelated to climate change. And we should get away from grumbling on about them. Far too many scientists use them as a shorthand. And it's very much influenced the debate for the last 15 years or so in the UK and abroad. The only thing that matters in terms of the temperature, the only thing that really matters in terms of the long-lived gases, some caveats in there, are the cumulative emissions, the build-up of the emissions. Every single day, the carbon dioxide from the previous day and the long-lived greenhouse gases build up every single day that we pump them out. They're not getting taken out of the atmosphere at the rate that we're putting them in. So we're building them up. It's that cumulative budget that matters. 20 different targets, irrelevant. But this rewrites the reason why we don't want it. That rewrites the whole chronology, the timeline. It says we can no longer we pass it on to our kids and you can power and the wind turbines are solved. We may have to do something by switching off the lights this afternoon and walking home. And we have to do something urgently, radically urgently, this afternoon, tomorrow, preferably about 5 or 10 years ago. So that changes the whole story to one that we don't like. So this sort of message is usually quite unpopular. But our scientists are not very popular or often all unpopular. So I would argue this is a credible way I like the way we normally look at it to the long-term target. Well, what do we make this? First, let's look at the latest emissions. Because we've been concerned about climate change, clear in 1992. The growth rate for the last 100 years, CO2, this is slightly CO2e, up to 2000, 2.7% per annum. Really like climate too, so we're all interested in climate change, and no doubt we've done something about it, except between 2000 and 2007, the growth rate went up, despite all of our flying around to international conferences to discuss climate change, emissions actually went up. This is quite stunning. This is a large increase, 3.5% per annum increase every single year, on already a larger number every year. It's quite exponential. And what we found recently, well, despite the right downturn here and there, the latest data shows a 5.9% increase in CO2 emissions. That's almost 6% increase during the time of economic downturn. That might be a bit of a blip, but what we're seeing here is basically an exponential curve. And any other species that was doing this, we do it with CO2 emissions, with TV ownership, and everything in our lives, pretty much. We know it on a genetic cul-de-sac. But we're sufficiently arrogant here to think we can get by on a round planet and do that with everything. So that's where we are at the moment. So we add the abject failure to reduce emissions with the science related to cumulative emissions, and there's nothing fancy new about that, it does actually go back a long way. What does that say about this magical number, this threshold between acceptable and dangerous climate change? Because that's the way to come out of the international negotiations. Well, firstly, the earlier we peak emissions, then the lower is the reduction rate after that. We need to stop emissions going up as quickly as possible, preferably in the past. Well, you may laugh at that. We had a lot of climate models do just that. Nordhaus's latest model, 2008 into 2005. 2009 model by Hanson from 2005. There were lots of people out there that think the TARDIS works, who work in the climate science field. And they have to do that because they want money from the policy makers. If you get the real results of your analysis, the policy makers will give you any money. This sort of stuff. Right, 2015. Let's imagine global emissions peak in 2015. That's the key of the budget here under the curve. Here's a good scientific uncertainty you always get. And this bit here is you've got to feed 9 billion people. You've got to feed people, you can't get emissions down below a certain level. This is extremely ambitious in terms of that level of emissions. If anyone's interested in this, it's about 6.5 gigatons, which is very, very low food emissions from 9 billion people. But that's what you've got here under the curve. 2015, that's the date the Stern Report, some of you may have heard of. 2015 is when Stern Report had the peak date. Now, why hasn't any climate scientist pointed out how stupid it was that 2015 peak date? No one thought about that, all disturbed. Yeah, we'll stay quiet about it, because you get a nice slow curve down here. If you say the global peaks in 2020, it comes a bit faster. If you peak in 2025, just off its ambitious, it's lands off a cliff. So this is very different. This is for a 50-50 chance of what we define as dangerous climate change. So that's not too positive. Let's take the deforestation out of that. Let's take the food emissions, and this is the area I particularly work on, looking at energy emissions. What's that leave? Well, firstly, by now, with the deforestation that we envisage over the next, well, probably 30 years, and the food emissions over the next 50 years, the emissions we've already pumped out between 2000 and 2012, we've blown the budget. Yeah, well, the bankers have been doing that for a long time, so we've just joined in as well. 13 of the 18 scenarios were stuffed. We've got to be really optimistic on the science, because there's a 50-50 chance of avoiding dangerous climate change. So if you check the scenarios that are based on here, are based on the AR4 and the IPCC. The IPCC, the big UN negotiation on this, they had a set of scenarios came out in the last negotiations that were called AR4, that was the assessment report 4. We're using the full range of their estimates, so we're not sort of privileging one side of the estimates or the other. And if you take their full range and you start playing with the numbers we're putting in here, you realise that 13 of their scenarios aren't possible. You've blown the budget. So the budgets vary. The budgets broadly, and in fact, the budgets broadly are how much you can dump in the atmosphere over the century, and that relates to the amount of temperature rise that you see. And the best correlation is between how much you stuff in the atmosphere over the century, that relates to the temperature in this century. That's the highest correlation you get. And the estimates of the 2 degrees C, they vary a lot. There's a lot of scientific uncertainty. You know, from geeks and monkeys, they vary from about 1,300 gigatons to 2,200 gigatons. You may quite little, or you may not. So the point I'm making here is that even if you're really lucky on the science, this is what your energy emissions have to do. They have to peak by 2020, and then come down at the rate here. Whereas this is zero emissions. This isn't carbon capture and storage, and all those other things that are going to be at least those who are low, about 100 grams of carbon per kilowatt hour. You talk about zero. So you took basically nuclear power and the renewables in there. Remember, electricity at the moment is 20% of what we consume. The reduction rate is 10-20% per annum. So for energy, the reduction rate will be 10-20% per annum, starting in 2020, coming down every single year down to zero emissions to give you enough scope to give you a 50-50 chance of 2 degrees centigrade. This story, the emission story, is completely neglected. Most scientists have no idea about emissions. So if you then start thinking, well, those reduction rates, that might mean that's something to you, may not. So just to give some sort of feel of it. Stern said in his report that anything greater than 1% reduction has only ever been associated with economic recession and upheaval. US, UK switched to natural gas, it's a big reduction in CO2 emissions, and faced a 40-fold increase in nuclear power over about 20 years, phenomenally fast, and yet it only went with 1% per annum reduction in emissions. So this was a massive shift to low carbon energy systems that had almost no reduction in emissions. And in fact, when the Apex factory emissions and shipping in there, which are not included in the Kyoto Protocol, if you factor those in, there was no reduction in emissions. For the best example we have of a society moving to a relatively low carbon energy system, with no reduction. That's because the economy grew. Now, I'm not saying this is, I'm advocating this, so I'm a bit sort of a communist report on this. Just to put it up there, this is the best example we have. The collapse of the Soviet Union gave us 5% per annum. The collapse of the Soviet Union gave us what we require, half of what we require globally, and for the wealthy parts of the world, probably a quarter of the reduction rate we would require to give us a 50-50 chance of 2 degrees centigrade. So it's not looking too positive. This is the good news, by the way. So what's a bit challenging? And no one speaks of any of these numbers, but you sit down with people that actually do the emissions data. These are all based on the standard numbers that are collected for the UNFCCC. So this looks too challenging. What about 4 degrees C? 4 degrees C, 3.5% reduction rate after peak in 2020. That's quite doable. The economists tell us we can do that. And we then might think, well, should we aim for 4 degrees C? It looks more realistic. 4 degrees C future. What does a 4 degrees C future look like? Now, there's a lot of uncertainties, which I'm sure Matt will pick up on some of these things later. If we look at this sort of future, which we can certainly get to, we can aim for that sort of emission budget, and most of the planet is water, and water has a very high thermal mass, and therefore what we find is the land temperature will be much higher than the global average. If you use global average of 4, the land will be somewhere like 5 or 6. We then start to see what that could look like, and there's a model run with all of the inherent uncertainties that go with models. Well, I've perhaps said make the economic models not accurate, but it's probably not true. On the hottest days, you can talk about something like a 6 to 8 degree temperature rise in China, 8 to 10 in Central Europe, and 10 to 12 in New York. Now, remember, these are just guidelines, but what we're talking about are very large increases in temperature during heatwave conditions, with infrastructures that were built, in our case, by the Victorians. And 20 to 30,000 people died in heatwaves in 2003. But remember, also, when it's hotter, less people die in the winter, so you have to balance these things out. But these are very challenging temperatures to survive in our current infrastructures. At the same time, the lower latitudes, at 2 degrees C, the big issue is precipitation, rain. And the models are rubbish on rain, despite what the models might try and tell us. They're rubbish on rain, but they're quite good on temperature. At 4 degrees C, the actual temperature starts to affect the agriculture, not just the change in rainfall that goes with it. The actual temperature changes the agriculture. And you get about a 40% reduction in some of the staples. That's our best estimate at the moment on this, as the population hits about 9 million. So we're stuck up here in the Northern Hemisphere, and the Southern Hemisphere is going up through to 9 million. Now, there are lots of things that we can try and do about this, but generally, when things are going pear-shaped, we don't reach the debating table, we reach the clashing point. So I don't know whether we'll actually deal with that appropriately. This is my polling, it's purely anecdotal polling of the scientists who work in this sort of area. This may well be wrong, but this is the impression I get. That basically, 4 degrees C is beyond what we might call normal. What we've envisioned in all our global community, it's hard to envision that existing in that sort of temperature world. If it occurs as quickly as we think it may occur, this could be as quickly as the middle of the century, certainly could be by 2060, 2070. If you put that along, then we don't know how to adapt to that. Ecosystems probably are not used to changing at that rate. Ecosystems can change, 40 BC is not a problem, but changing that quickly is a real problem. And also, most worryingly, in some respects, is that it's, I would say 75% of scientists who work on this sort of area would suggest at 4 degrees C it will not be stable, the temperature will keep going up. It would have triggered other tipping points, discontinuities in the system. Now, there's a lot of uncertainty where they exist, and a lot of scientists exaggerate what they know about them. But the higher the temperature goes, the higher the chances you hit these discontinuities, these tipping points, these non-linearities, when the Earth starts to do things over and above what we can control. At 2 degrees C, you're probably most scientists would argue suggest it will be stable in most of the tipping points. So I'd go as far as saying 4 degrees C should be avoided at all costs. I do genuinely mean at all costs on that. Now, so that's the good news. Now we say that's a split paper amongst those that haven't caused the problem and those of us that have and know that we have for the last 20 or so years. And then this is a bit more worrying. This is based on a paper that I published with a colleague of mine in January 2011, if you want, and in the Royal Society Journal. This is just taking a bit out of it. This is the non-analyst model. This is the non-OECD, the poorer part of the world, but doesn't include the China, so a very big group. If their emissions go up at 3.5% per annum, that's half their current growth rate for these parts of the world. So they immediately overnight will change that for us, help us. If they hit in 2025, the Chinese don't think they will. They think they'll peak there in 2030. The Indians think well after that, and the Americans probably never. So yeah, no one thinks they'll peak in anywhere near these rates. If they then come down at a rate that is twice the level the economists say is doable with a growing economy, and many economists say this, the climate world is awash with people who say this on the economic side, that 3.5% to 4% of that's the best you can come off. So twice that, you then say, what's left? That's the area under the curve they're taking. Out of the 2 degrees C world, what's left for us? Well, that, with 2010, come down at a rate, which even as an engineer, which I'm well sure I think you can do pretty challenging things, but to peak in the passes attached to you, and then to come down at an infinite rate is even faster, even more than that. So that to give us a 50-50 chance. And I think this is what we should be trying to do. Because this is a very, very challenging picture for the poor parts of the world. And their emissions should, we might want their emissions to go up. Because if their emissions go up, their development improves, at least in the short term. So we have to then come off our budget even faster than the wealthy parts of the world to give emission space to the poor parts of the world. With the impact both by constraints on access to fossil fuel through carbon constraints and given that bridge, plus impacts from the weather from the change of the climate rather. So why is this different from what we normally hear? Well, almost every analysis out there, we have not used the real data from 2000. Almost, with every single example of this, almost every analysis will have shown the growth rate somewhere between 1 and 2% per annum is to be near between 3.5% to 4% per annum. And they'll also take up to the peak at only about 1 to 2% per annum, where it looks much more like they carry up to the peak at about 3-4% per annum. So short-term growth is underplayed. The peak year is Machiavellian. The peak year is Machiavellian, very dangerously misleading. No one thinks of the peak in 2015 or 16, but they all put it in their models. And the reduction rate is universally taken by astrologists. That's how fast it comes. The emissions flaws are poorly understood. That's a problem for the scientists at the time. Dealing with it's a bit for food. Geoengineering is widespread. I can only find one low carbon scenario that does not include geoengineering. That one is the 2 degrees C scenario. It doesn't include that. That means sucking the stuff out of the air in the future. It may work. But I wouldn't rely on Harry Potter to predict through scenarios. It may work. We should research it. But we don't know if it will. So to actually put it in seems very dangerous. The split between Annex 1 and non-Annex 1 is neglected. And there's massive assumptions about big technologies. And we just need the time. We think the ball can go into the China shop, smash it to China, and burst back out, and glue it back together. No understanding of entropy in any of this sort of system level analysis that goes on at home. Right, it's all disturbing. So, some good news. Because that's what we used to work on, about what we can do. Just to put some numbers on it. This is for pretty much an outside chance of 2 degrees C in the wealthy parts of the world, and really should be much better than this. We need about 40% reduction in our emissions by 2015. What was that, 3 years from now? 7% by 2020, pretty much down to zero emissions. That's not just electricity, that's everything. Flying, ships, heating, cars, the whole shebang. So basically decarbonise. Now that's impossible. But if we don't do this, and if the poor parts of the world do what they say they're going to do, they probably will do, quite right. So then is living with 4 degrees C futures, that any less possible? The future is impossible. So from a researcher's point of view, that's great, we should get some money to do some research. But in the big society world, we won't. The future is not one that we can contemplate at the moment, and therefore you can't show these numbers normally because people don't like to see them, they much prefer cruelty business. So let's have a bit of agency and equity. And then a bit on technology, and I'll whip through this as quick as I can. 7 billion people on the planet, but most of them cause a problem, most of them are virtually missing nothing. There's some nonsense spoken about the Chinese all trying to own fridges. If you take a middle person in China, increase their emissions at 10% per annum, they still end up having very little emissions even in 20 or 30 years' time. It's not about the poor. Not, it's sustainability perhaps, partly. It's not about carbon dioxide emissions. Coming off the curve, we know it's about, it's people like us. So what do you need to here. The 80-20 rule, Pareto, or Fogo Pareto. Engineers use it all the time, it's a rule of thumb. It's a rule of thumb, it's just a guide, that's all it is. 80% something in place, 20% it's not a bad guide to these sorts of things. It actually holds quite well for emissions from at least the first 2 months, maybe the third one. 80% emissions from 20% of the population, run that 3 times, 50% emissions from 1% of the world's population. Now, I wouldn't be too surprised if we looked at this group, we saw massive differentials in emissions. But the people here that have emissions are. That are maybe not orders of magnitude, but something maybe an order of magnitude higher than people in this group. So huge differences in emissions between the population. So therefore, 50% from 1% of the population means that we maybe only have to aim for policies at a small percentage of the world's population. But who's in it? Well, every climate scientist that any pontificated journalist or sick out there joining the bandwagon, any academic in the OECD, any anyone who gets to the planet once a year, if you have 30k a year, pretty much everyone always is after that in the UK. Remember, the moat time in the UK is about 17,000, that's what most people earn, £30,000 a year, and then that is somewhere in the 1% category. So everyone here, I'm making a general, my guess is we're all actually artists, cyclists getting 30k, so maybe some of you hitchhiked up here. Obviously not. Now, the question is, are we prepared, and that's including 20 million wealthy people in China as well, are we prepared to make these changes now? And the answer, I think, probably isn't now, is it? We're not prepared. We'd much rather see poor people in other parts of the world pegging it in the news, which are watching reality TV. We don't care, really. Let's be blunt about it. We really do not care about what this may mean. Even if some of the alternatives are right about this, we're prepared to accept the risk that other people may suffer from it. We think we've got to buy our way out of it. But we can do it all. We can get by our way out of it. It's the technology. Very quickly, quick through this. These lights, I think these are not combat fluorescents. I think these are halogens. That means there's 4 kilowatts in here. 4 kilowatts of heat going into this room during the daytime, and I can see light out there, even in Newcastle. Yeah. So we have a new building here, powered by electricity from power stations in coal from Colombia, probably, or Venezuela, or so, having us on it, when there's light out there. So light means electricity, you need a transmission network, power stations, and you need Venezuela to get out the ground. Put the numbers under there, 10 units of useful light. With these light bulbs, 20% light, 80% heat. Transmission losses are about 8%, most of it the distribution of the low voltage network. Power stations are only 35 to 45% efficient. Look in the textbooks, they'll tell you they're 50 or 55% efficient. Working in power stations is only 35 to 45% efficient. And then you'll get some out of the ground as well. We get to be on a train every single day for 40 years of a power station. So, anyway, so you're all the same there, you save one unit here. 13 there, so it's the right stuff and you're not using it and you save a huge amount over there, yet all the focus is on this stuff and actually it's the demand side, but that's what we should hope. You can do this stuff quickly, you can't do that stuff quickly. The demand side dwarfs the supply side. Cars, this is what you normally see, a car driving around the UK now, 175 grams of carbon per kilometre, new car in the forecourt, average 150 grams. The EU plan, ambitious level, 130 grams by 2015, and you can buy it out, so the wealthy are about to buy their four-wheel drive, so we'll be fine. So we can buy that. BMW in 2008 had a fancy sort of colloquial type 160 horsepower. I can't stand those sort of cars, but both of them. 109 grams. Yeah, very, very efficient. VW 85, 19. Audi in 1998 had a car that's 75 grams. Look at the reductions. These are cars that do exactly the same thing. They all sit in the cube at the same speed. And now, we know that 90% of all vehicle kilometres are travelled by cars that are under 8 years old. That's without the scrappage scheme. Under 8 years old. So we know we can change the emissions from cars very rapidly to change the quantities. No electric cars, just diesels. No hybrids, just diesels. Just standard cars. 50% reduction by 2020, just by saying to Camry. Actually, how about the policy so no car can be sold over 110 grams from 2013 onwards, and then improve that 3-4% per annum? We still drive around diesel cars, not bikes, not public transport, we still drive diesel cars. So obviously we should be going far further than that, but we're saying we can do a huge amount. Reverse the occupancy trends, because remember most cars may have 4 or 5 seats, but only 1.3 people in them. And if you reverse the trend of the last few years, it's 70% reductions, right? To conclude, would I like to conclude one? Basically, we add all the cool stuff together as optimistic as we can be, 2 degrees C is impossible. At least within the orthodoxy, unless we think outside the orthodoxy, and that's hopefully where artists will understand. And we're headed towards 4 degrees C by 2070. Now, it could be 2050, it could be 2100, but that's the sort of ballpark, and we're way ahead of the emissions curves we're thinking about. This is not a message of futility. This is a message coming in from our spend better. It's a wake-up call. If we take our rose-tinted spectacles and just accept where are we today, and hope resides out of that reality. So there are things we can do, but not pretend we're not here. So that's a nice quote to finish off with, really, is that every great obstacle transforming the world, we have the clarity and imagination to conceive that it could be different. If artists can't have clarity and imagination, it's that what then you're going to get nowhere. But let's not be too optimistic. This was me until a few years ago. I'm in a 3-bedroom house in Berlin, a terrace house in the Peak District. I'm now living in a 2-bedroom flat. It's a very nice flat. We've got in Bangladesh, we've about 30 other people in it. So still a pretty, very good property. We have patio heaters in our gardens. We have 10 halogen light bulbs in the kitchen, the light of the kitchen. The Edison light bulb in the 1920s was better than those things. We have two tons of four-wheel drive, which has all 70 kilograms of useless flesh to get the daily mail on Sunday. We drive our kids to school. We think it's okay for business type people to have private jets. Musicians are flying the other way, climate change causes the sewer out there. We celebrate the excesses of celebrities. Absolutely everything is about excess. We think that right to fly and drive whatever we want, year round strawberries, headlines in Bar, birthdays in Barcelona, double boy fitness, home soon, a second home, two cars, 3D media, and 9 million people on the planet. I mean, get out of that with better technology. I love technology, but just play with the numbers. You haven't got a cat in hell chance of dealing with this problem with technology. Technology is a prerequisite for dealing with it in the medium to long term. It's a short term issue about us, about the wealth in the world doing a lot less whilst you put in a low carbon energy system. Maybe we're about to be profit in the future, so that's what we choose to do. But I hope there's any other way out of that. Well, probably the distance.